Welcome to the Dublin Festival of History podcast. In this episode, Martina Devlin, Dermot Ferriter, Patsy McGarry, Rona McGreevy and Margaret O'Callaghan look at the 1916 Rising centenary commemorations. Recorded at the Printworks, Dublin Castle on the 23rd of September 2016.
And welcome to the Dublin Festival of History, and allow me to introduce your most distinguished panel tonight. I think we're going to have a fantastic evening of opinion. So first of all, to my left, Martina Devlin is an award-winning columnist for the Irish Independent, and she's also a best-selling novelist, and her most recent book is called About Sisterland. Dermot Ferriter is Professor of Modern Irish History at UCD. I'm sure you're all very familiar with them. And interesting for us tonight, he was a member of the Expert Advisory Committee to the Government on the 1916 commemorations and author of many books, most relevant to us, A Nation Not a Rabble, The Irish Revolutions, 1913-23. Patsy McGarry is Religious Affairs Correspondent with the Irish Times. An interesting fact I found out about you today, Patsy. In 1989, you set up the first independent radio newsroom in the Republic, and that was at Capital Radio, which is now FM 104. That's your contribution to the nation, so that thank you for that.
No, it was illegal before that. I was involved with pirate radio before that. No, for freedom of the airwaves.
Ronan McGreevy is a news reporter with the Irish Times, and he's the editor of Was It For This? Reflections on the Easter Rising, and Wherever the Firing Line Extends, Ireland and the Western Front. And finally, Margaret O'Callaghan is senior lecturer at Queen's University Belfast School of History. She received her PhD at Cambridge, and her most recent publications are on the politics of commemorating the 1916 Rising in the 1970s, on Roger Casement, British Imperial Policy and the First World War. So that's your panel this evening, ladies and gentlemen. Margaret, I might start with you on that a sense of angst there was about commemorating 1916, because there was this sense that 1966 didn't go that well.
Yeah, I got interested in commemoration because a couple of years ago I did a research project on 1966. And I suppose one of the reasons why commemorating 1916 was deemed to be problematic was because what was said about how it had been commemorated in 66. I'm based in Belfast, so when I did that project with Mary Daly, who's here in Dublin, I didn't look at the Conor Cruise O'Brien argument, which really was to the effect that the commemoration here in the South had somehow generated the troubles in the North in 69, to put it at its crudest. I kind of looked at what was actually happening in Belfast, in Derry, and in other places in 66. So that's how I got into it, and I can talk more about that if you like. I suppose more recently, I tried to look at the debate on commemorating 1916 in the 1970s, because in the 70s, it seemed like, though Conor Cruise O'Brien had become incredibly unpopular politically, he's a very interesting man, but he was demonised. But to a certain extent, I think that his views about commemorating the Rising had been taken on board broadly within the society. So in a recent essay, I've tried to look at the coalition government of 1973 to 1977. And proposals within that government to stop commemorating 1916 in the way in which it had been done previously. So there were all kinds of suggestions in 72, and Germans done work on this as well, in 72 into 73, they're just trying to low-key things. By 1973-74, Conor Cruise O'Brien is proposing that all commemoration of 16, of Wolfe Tone, of Robert Emmet, the whole panoply of Irish nationalist commemorations are kind of shrunken into an event to be called a National Day of Reconciliation or a National Day of Commemoration. And effectively, that's what the coalition government kind of adopted in 1974. This day is supposed to be St. Patrick's Day. To an extent, that never really takes off. We don't all remember the National Day of Commemoration or the National Day of Reconciliation. But what did, I think, take off was the notion of 1916 and commemorating it being incredibly dangerous. So really, from the mid-70s onwards, I suppose until Bertie Ahern decided post-peace process in 06, we've had a very muted version of commemoration because the culture has broadly accepted Cruise O'Brien's kind of counterinsurgency argument that a broader cultural capital of commemorating 1916 was the sea in which, if you like, the provisional IRA swam, and for that reason, it was dangerous, and what could you do with it? That's what's the problem that presented to the Irish state is we all, to some degree, share the cultural capital of Irish republicanism and Irish nationalism. So the problem, as I see it, is the debate is kind of about who owns that or who doesn't.
Dermot Ferriter, you had your own concerns of a slightly different kind. You were on the expert advisory committee to the government, and they had a launch for commemorating 1916 a while ago in which a video was shown. You were very apprehensive about the entire approach, including the appointment of a marketing executive, John Colcannon, to head up the project. You warned against commercialization and commodification and a gathering mark too, but this is what this all smacks of, you said about the video. You said it was embarrassing, unhistorical shit. Were your fears realized, and if not, why not?
I was actually being quite polite about it. There were various other expletives I used that weren't published at the time. That was the polite version. I did have those fears. And the commodification of it, or the idea that it would become a branding exercise, was something I was concerned about and others were concerned about. I think it's important to put some context on this, that yes, the government did appoint a so-called expert advisory group of historians, and I was one of them. And we were not an executive group, we weren't a policy formation group, we were an advisor group. Now, to advise, you need to have something to advise on, which comes from the government. And there was very little coming from the government for a long time, so we were concerned about that. And then when something did come, it was in the form of the appointment of Jonathan Cannon, who went on to do a very good job, I should add, but we didn't start off very well, maybe, because that was what was produced initially. It was called Ireland Inspires. And again, Ireland Inspires what? Where was the history? There was no history in this video. It was all about Google and images of modernity and a thrusting present. And, you know, there was this idea that we had to reimagine our future, which is complete and utter bullshit, you know, and it's one of those phrases that can find its way into...
Do you think that was driven by the fear that commemorating violence could be hijacked, say, by republicanism?
To an extent, it was also driven by inactivity, lack of concrete planning, lack of a programme, and they thought that if we can farm this out to somebody who's familiar with branding Ireland, well then they can come up with a branding that's appropriate, you know. At the same time, they would have been conscious that they needed to be seen to do something in case it was hijacked. Hijacking is always a part of commemoration, it always has been, it always will be, and they would have been conscious of the... you know, the opportunity that was there for others to wrap the green flag around themselves. One of the things that the advisory group was conscious of was, firstly, that the commemoration would be historically accurate, that it would be proportionate, that it would set an appropriate tone, but also that the state did not have to apologize or be neutral about its own origins. So the state had to be out there so that others wouldn't hijack it. So that was part of it. And I don't think they started it very well, but I think they learned from that mistake. And I think what came afterwards was much more nuanced and much more complex. And
what do you think
satisfying.
They got right?
They got right the idea of complicating the narrative. And it was a mantra that we had from the outset. In contrast to what Margaret's been talking about in 1966, in contrast to a time during the Troubles where any commemoration of 1916 was poisoned by the Troubles, this was about recognising a multiplicity of different narratives, of different voices, of different experiences, that it would be a much broader canvas, a much broader framework. There was a time in 1966 when it was about shocked or far shocked law. That was one of the commemorative pageants. So it was about 7 days and seven men. Whereas this year's commemoration was about a hell of a lot more. It was about how ordinary people were living and dying in 1916.
I suppose one thing I think we should remember, though, commemoration is usually about the present in which the commemoration takes place, rather than, it tells us more about the tensions and the politics of the time than the period in which it's actually seeking to commemorate. And I think that's really important. And in 66, I mean, Le Mas just wanted to sell a message that, you know, Ireland was booming economically. So you know, the intentions of governments at different times are always political.
One of the last things that was said, I just finished this there, was that you know, one of the first of the state commemorations was 1915, the commemoration of 1915, the funeral of Jeremiah O'Donovan Rossa, which obviously is famous for Patrick Pearse's clarion call. And Pearse famously said in 1915, there is only one definition of Irish freedom. And I think the point of 2016 was to rubbish that. There isn't any such thing as a singular definition of freedom in Ireland 100 years ago, or there wasn't.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. You wrote about it at the time, and I remind me to come back to you about Owen McNeill, because you mentioned him. Patsy McGarry, you had particular fears about 1916 commemoration too. In one article, you quoted the Fianna Fáil Attorney General, Paul Gallagher, who he said, the Rising cannot be justified by what happened in retrospect, and the leaders of the rebellion had no legitimacy whatsoever. The Rising leaders were a self-absorbed group of brave idealists who had never represented anybody. The whole notion of blood sacrifice and your fears around that, were they allayed in how things turned out, or do you still think there's a fundamental error there in how we mark this event?
I was, I suppose, heartened by the way in which the whole thing panned out. I have to confess, at the beginning of the year, I was very, very far from being so. There was an event here in these grounds on New Year's Day. It lashed rain. It was a Sunday. And the only people mentioned by the Taoiseach, or by the people organising the commemoration, were the 78 rebels who died in 1916. There was no reference to the remaining of the 485 people altogether who died, mainly civilians, ordinary dubs, who had no hand, act, or part in it, who were never consulted about it, and indeed who were thoroughly and completely opposed to it. There was no reference to the 40 children under the age of 17 who were killed in it. And it seemed to be that we were heading down the same road, or a similar road, to 1966. I am very glad to say that did not happen. I was very glad to hear, too, what Paul Gallagher had to say in a debate in Castlenau College during the year, but also the Attorney General for Northern Ireland, a Catholic, Felix Larkin, who earlier this year described 1916 as profoundly morally wrong. And I actually do believe that. I do believe there was no moral justification for 1916. I am not alone in that. Owen McNeill said that in a memorandum in February of 1916, allegedly agreed to by Pearse. But Pearse, that was one of the three deceptions he indulged in where McNeill was concerned in the lead up to the Rising. He and Connolly as leaders of a minority within the minority that was the Irish Volunteers. I mean, they perpetrated a fraud, basically, that it turned out differently. Well, that's a matter for historians like Margaret and Dermot to sort out. But I do not think there was any justification at all for 1916. We were on the road to home rule in some form, probably with two administrations, because of the absolute determination of people in Northern Ireland, the unionist majority, not to be ruled from Dublin. We had two administrations anyhow, but look at all the bloodshed we had in the meantime, and indeed we're still dealing with the consequences on this island today. In fact, you could say that the fact that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael couldn't come together in government this year is a manifestation of the bitterness whose seeds were sown.
Patsy, can I ask you, do you feel more or less comfortable expressing those views post the Easter Week commemorations?
Well, I expressed them before the Easter Week.
And how did you get on when you expressed them then?
Well, I should be very honest, inspired, if that's the word to use, by what had happened here on New Year's Day. I wrote a piece in the paper, basically attacking 1916 or criticising it, and in particular, Pearse's blood sacrifice idea, his comparison of himself to Jesus Christ in a poem he wrote for his mother the night before he was executed, and this being equating himself or the Easter Rising with the redemption, the Christian theology of salvation, etc., which, to say the least, was over the top. And when I wrote the piece, I braced myself, thinking I'm going to get a hell of a kicking for this, and I prepared myself for it. But it didn't happen. I was absolutely delighted to discover that so many people, including people I would never have expected, agreed with me. And I became aware then, very early on in January this year, that the Irish people at large had a far more complex interpretation and understanding of 1916 than certainly was the case in 1966, or even the 1970s, or 1980s or 1990s. And I think that bode very well for what did happen. Another thing that helped in a minor way was Arlene Foster came down here to attend a lecture on 1916 in Christchurch Cathedral. Arlene Foster had little sympathy with 1916 for obvious reasons, that I asked her about it there. And she said how she associated it with the campaign of violence in Northern Ireland, which her father was an RSC officer, or UC officer, who the attempts to kill him, a bus in which he was travelling as a child to school, a school bus, was shot up by the IRA. So she associated the legacy of 1916 with that. But she partook, she did say when she became First Minister, she wasn't going to attend any commemorations. Well, it was funny, actually, the event was advertised by the Church of Ireland here as a commemoration, and very rapidly it sent out another press release saying it was a lecture to mark 1916, and that's how you get around these things politically. But that helped too.
Martina Devlin, what about Northern Nationalists? Do you think that they felt included, or is it safe enough for them to commemorate this event and their part in the story?
Well, Northern Nationalists have always felt part of 1916 and part of the 1916 story, but then where they would feel sidelined is afterwards. But what I noticed about the 1916 commemoration, celebration, was that ordinary people embraced it in a way that nobody could have predicted, and in fact, as Patsy acknowledges, some people predicted they may not. I was in O'Connell Street on Easter Sunday for the BBC and on a viewing stand right opposite the GPO, and I was amazed by the stream of people coming in, not dignitaries, just people who wanted to be there and to be part of this day that meant something to them. And you can't legislate for that, and you can't really prepare for that. You don't know, governments don't know how willingly people will embrace a commemoration. They had their kids with ancestors' medals pinned to anoraks. I spoke to people who had letters that their grandfather sent their grandmother from Frongoc internment camp. And it was quite nuanced. It wasn't, yay, we beat the Brits. It wasn't like that. I mean, I actually heard a grandfather talking to his grandson saying, look, you know, son, we were enemies once, but that's all in the past now, and sure, don't you have an auntie so-and-so who's English? So, and then the other thing about it is that the way it was commemorated and celebrated, for me it was a celebration. I think that they were an extraordinarily idealistic, self-sacrificing generation, and we could do a bit with a bit more of that idealism today. I think it's too easy to knock them from the distance of 100 years and say they had no legitimacy. You know, these people went out to die for Ireland. Obviously, it's better to live for Ireland. Of course it is. I'm not putting forward the idea that a blood sacrifice is advisable, but we're judging them by the standards of today. And if you look elsewhere in Europe, the idea of going out and fighting for what you believed in was by far, you know, was relatively common. So, you know, we have to stop judging people by the standards of today. But just going back to the way people embraced that celebration, what I noticed was the proclamation was a really important part of it for people. And I mean, Proclamation Day was held in the schools, of course. And I mean, the vitality of the words in that proclamation came home to me again this year. I think we were all reminded of the aspirations there. And what's interesting about them is they reach out to people in the north as well, the aspirations, the inclusivity of it. And that's been forgotten, I think, largely. It was forgotten in the Civil War and the War of Independence and then in the struggles to form a new state and for the new state to bed down. It was a brilliant opportunity, the centenary, to have unionist politicians in Dublin participating in that celebration as a friendly sister state. And that didn't really happen. I accept that Arlene Foster did come for an event, but no senior unionist politician came to the big set piece on Easter Sunday, which was the important one. And, you know, the British ambassador to Ireland, Dominic Chilcott, had no problem being in a prime seat in the viewing stand and talking to people and saying it was important that he was there as a representative of Her Majesty's government. But I was saddened that unionist politicians lacked the vision, and that politicians here and other people failed to put the building blocks in place to facilitate them coming, to help them along to take that step, you know, because it's you can't just issue an invitation a fortnight before and think that people will be capable of coming. And I don't just mean logistically, I mean intellectually. So, I mean, that was a lost opportunity from 2016 for me. And I hope we learn that lesson, because we've other commemorations coming, other centenaries, and I think that, you know, concerted efforts have to be made to build bridges and to make it possible for unionist politicians to come.
You know, I take your point about not judging people by the standards of today and the tradition of, you know, armed resistance, you know, across Europe and throughout the world, you know, from America to France and Britain itself when they had their civil war. Would you acknowledge, though, that the problem for us is that that same logic was being used by Republican paramilitaries in relatively recent time, and that was the fear of legitimizing the more recent armed struggle by commemorating the older armed struggle?
Well, you know, there's double think about, you're talking about the Troubles, of course, and there's double think about that. I mean, it's exactly the same legitimacy, of course it is. I don't think that, and I think the state hasn't really addressed this properly. It's that 1916 violence was good violence, and 1970s and 1980s violence was bad violence. It all sprang from the same source. It just lasted a heck of a lot longer in the north. I mean, 30 years of it. You know, it's actually something to celebrate that we have this peace process. I think it's our marvel of marvels, you know, that we've lived to see this. But we can't rest on our laurels with it. And I think it's very important to engage, to keep those bridges, to build the bridges, to have much more interaction. And post Good Friday Agreement, really, what's happened is the North has become a place apart in a way that it never was through the Troubles.
And actually, we'll come to that, because we're going to have to look forward to the War of Independence and the Civil War and partition, and of course that's going to be a lot more complicated. Ronan McGreevy, do you think we resolved that fundamental conundrum about the legitimacy of blood sacrifice?
No, I don't. I actually don't think that argument is really relevant. I just think that it's very hard to judge people by, as Martina says, by the standards of today. Now, you know, we have an internal dilemma here, in that our state came as a result of violence. There is a direct connection between 1916 and the state we have today. Could our state have come about by peaceful means? We don't know. I mean, it's counterfactual history to suggest that it is. It would do. I wonder sometimes whether we ever wanted independence. This may sound an extraordinary thing to state, but there wasn't any great clamour in 1916 for a republic. It was a minority interest. People wanted, essentially, as far as I could see, from what I've read, you know, they obviously wanted greater autonomy for Britain, but they wanted a form of they wanted to be part of the British Empire. A lot of them. Willie Redmond talked about Irish people being imperialist nationalists, that they were still part of the British Empire, which has a bad rap nowadays. But a lot of even Catholics back in the early part of the 20th century saw it as a civilizing agent in the world. So there is no resolution to this. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, history is what happened. It's going back into whether the legitimacy of it would. It was right or wrong. To me, it's not the most important
thing. And can I ask you too, because you've done a lot of work about World War One, and your predecessor, if that's the right term, in the Irish Times, Kevin Myers, of course, was plugging away at this for years and years and years, and it was never acceptable, really, to mark the participation in World War One, and at some point in the last 10 years it became okay. Why do you think that shift happened? And do you think there was a compatibility about marking those two military events, World War One and 1916, roughly around the same time?
I think there's one reason, the simple reason why Irish people can remember the First World War Day now is because of the peace process. I'm pretty sure about that. 1998, you had the unveiling of the Island of Ireland Peace Park in Messines. There's a big commemoration coming up there next year. But I think that it's essentially the fact that we have a peace process here, it makes it a lot easier for people to recognise the fact that their relatives fought in the British Army, and that is that to me is a good thing. I mean, the fact of the matter is, whether you agree with whether the Irishmen who fought in the First World War were on the side of right or not, the numbers who fought in the First World War were of a factor of 10 or 15 times what was involved in either the Easter Rising or the War of Independence. To give some example, the number of people who actually got service pensions for having seen active service in any of the conflicts, according to the Military Pensions Archives, is about 18,000. Isn't that right, Jim? It's something like that. 18,000. The number of Irish who served in the First World War is in the region of 270,000, in my mind.
Margaret.
I think morality is very complex, as I'm sure we're all aware. And, I mean, as an historian, I don't really like to look at the past through the eyes of a moralist. But if we must, I think we also have to say that it's difficult to celebrate the First World War as a monument to moral probity if we think of the appalling deaths of millions of men all over the world. Also, it's very difficult, I think, to look at empire as an unmitigated moral good. And I think what you say is very true. I think Ireland probably was quite divided in the early 20th century on how much independence it wanted or didn't want. I don't think that the 1916 Rising was a blood sacrifice, though I think Pierce had blood sacrificial ideas. But I think a lot of the, what were called at the time, advanced nationalists possibly pushed for revolution because they were afraid of the successful absorption of Ireland within the empire. So it's a complex, we can't go back and have an opinion poll on the dead, but on the other hand, people in Ireland had voted for Home Rule since 1886, their democratic will had been thwarted in 86, in 1893, when the Liberals got back in 1907, they had no intention of introducing a Home Rule bill, and by the time it was introduced, it certainly was a very reduced version of what might have happened. So I don't think what we should do in talking about commemoration is fight the battles of the past all over again, because we're not really going to get anywhere, and I suppose that's what historians try to do. Which is fine.
Ronan, quickly, actually, no, Patsy first.
But it's not easily amenable to shortcuts.
We are not judging the people of 1916.
You just judged all of them. You said it was blood sacrifice.
Margaret, we're not judging the people of 1916 our blood sacrifice by the standards of today. You go back to the people of the time, like Owen McNeill, who dismissed out of hand this idea of blood sacrifice at the time, or the justification for rebellion.
But this
at the
is
time.
Just doing the past. Yeah. Like
yeah. He did Ping that in 1916, in February 1916, in a memorandum discovered by FX Martin in 1966 or thereabouts. So, I mean, by the standards of the time, it was outlawed by, I mean, he was the leader of the Irish Volunteers at the time. But what is wrong with 1916?
Just to say, Patsy, he was the leader of the Irish Volunteers, and he was not a pacifist.
No, he wasn't.
And he believed...
Sorry, who are you talking about now?
Owen McNeill. And I'm not a pacifist.
But not at that time.
No.
But let's put context on him, too.
Yes.
He wasn't just about the countermand order in 1916.
Of course.
You know. Well,
that's what he's become, Diarmaid, isn't it?
Well, I mean, that was one of the opportunities that was there this year, was to look at Owen McNeill in a much broader way.
There was a reason.
If you heard what Owen McNeill had to say, for example, about the conduct of the First World War and the decision by John Redmond, for example, as leader of the Irish Parliamentary Party, to throw his weight behind the First World War, he had visceral things, Owen McNeill, to say about that. So, we have to be very, we can be very selective in what we choose to highlight. And there is a lot of judgment going on. I interviewed Richard Evans at a Dublin History Festival a couple of years ago, and he was asked about this counterfactual history and what if they had done this instead of that. And he said the worst thing a historian can do is wish a personality change on their study, on their subjects, you know, or wish that they had done better. You know, it does come back to this idea of, you know, of trying to understand them through the lights of their time. And it is not the same 100 years on. And I would say the same in relation to latching commemoration onto the peace process by saying that there should have been more bridge building and there should have been unionists here. And, you know, I was very conscious of that when, again, we were in this official role of advising that this couldn't be an extension of the peace process because it would just be so contrived that, again, it wouldn't say anything about us and about what we regard as important in the evolution of our state. Of course unionists weren't going to be commemorating 1916. Why would they commemorate 1916? So there are times when you just have to turn your back.
Can I let Patsy come in? Patsy, I recall Garrett Fitzgerald talking about his father who was in the GPO and said that in the week when they were actually in the GPO, they were really anxious about what they were doing and the legitimacy of what they were doing, and they discussed it frequently.
After the act had begun. Yeah. I mean, I'm talking about...
And in contrast to recent events, they did call a ceasefire after a week.
Patsy finish his point, and then I come to Ruben.
I'll come back to repeat what I said. Judging what happened by the standards of the time, as articulated by Owen McNeill, there was no grounds for blood sacrifice or for the 1916 rising, number one. Number two, what it did do, 1916, and my basic problem with it, is that it blessed and legitimised physical force violence, which has beset this island of ours, or did, since then, certainly throughout the greater part of the 20th century. That was even an element of the Sinn Féin commemoration when they took apostolic lineation and they had a section in their commemoration up in the Ambassador Cinema devoted to the hunger strikers who were seen in direct line with the men of 1916 in the fight for Irish freedom. That's what
there is an international theoretical
violent British imperialism is also a reason Republicans taking up arms.
Ronan McGreevy.
Well, you were talking about Desmond Fitzgerald. There's a fantastic piece in the Irish Times in 1966 called Inside the GPO, which when he talks about, you know, looking out, Pierce is looking at all the looters and so on and so forth. They did discuss the morality of what they were doing, but they always came to the same conclusion that what they were doing was right. But to go back to Desmond Fitzgerald, one of the things that Desmond Fitzgerald said is one of the reasons they had their rising was because there was a morbid fear among advanced nationalists that Ireland was simply going to become a province of the United Kingdom.
They'd
seen it in the First World War through all the thousands of Irishmen who had joined up. And they felt that if they did not strike then, that Ireland would just become subsumed into the British. And, you know, I don't think myself... Here's a counterfactual argument that independence is necessarily was inevitable in our country. I don't believe that was the case. And there's an essay. Sorry, I'm going to
You put a point into my head that I had wanted to make.
Was it for this Reflections on the Easter Rising? There's an essay by Garrett Fitzgerald in 2006 in which he reflected on 90 years since the Rising, and he said, and this is an interesting counterpoint to what John Bruton has been saying, that if we hadn't got out from under the British rule in 1921, we got out just in time because the British welfare state came in well before the First World War, as we know. And, you know, I was... Irish people, if we hadn't been radicalised by the Rising, there could be a case of, yes, Irish people would love independence. Would it be like a United Ireland or an independent Scotland? Yeah. It'll be next year or the year after.
But British welfare state would have been better.
Absolutely. There's another argument that we never had.
Yeah.
And this
That's
is
really interesting.
This is to say, leaving aside the morality or the of nationalism, would we have been better off in the first 50 years if we had stayed with the British? In terms of if we were in part of the United Kingdom. Now, I'm not making a moral argument as to whether we should be independent. Independence, as we know, has an intrinsic worth that's far more than the economics. But the fact of the matter is, for the first 50 years of independence, you know, this state did not progress at all economically.
Our population
would have been another 50 years of conflict. If it hadn't happened in 1916, it would have happened at another time, and it would have kept happening. And I mean, that's the thing, we can talk about minorities, and you're absolutely right, Patsy, what you're saying. There was so much opposition in 1916 to the Rising, and that was remembered this year. Yeah, maybe not as much as it should have been.
I want to give Martina an opportunity.
But if it hadn't happened at that time, you know, you're left with this question. If you say, you know, another 50 years, how much conflict would there have been on the part of those who were never going to accept British rule in Ireland?
Well, what it produced was two entities, one a failed political entity in Northern Ireland and a sectarian state, indeed another sectarian state down here, which was a failed economic entity. And by 1961, something like 2.6 million was the population of this state, an impoverished state. I mean,
I'm going to come to that point, but I want to give Martina an opportunity
to answer.
Is that
a lament for the British Empire?
No. Cheap shot, Margaret.
I promise to come back to that, but Martina, you know, I'm going to give you an opportunity just to defend that point about the connection between modern terrorism and 1916. And Sinn Féin did make a concerted effort, you know, to leverage it as best they could. And indeed, I wondered, was Gerry Adams' absence from Dublin on the day when he went to Belfast actually the admission of failure, that they had failed to do that?
I think the state took ownership of 1916, as Dermot said, and I think they did a very good job of taking ownership of it. And for me, you know, it was seeing people remember their relatives, the kind of unsung heroes and heroines of 1916, their grannies and granddads whose names will never be known. They're just remembered in those families. I thought that that was wonderful to see and to hear stories being exchanged, rather than the signatories and the faces and the names we'd all recognise. But just to go back to Dermot's point, well, I think it did matter to have a senior unionist present on O'Connell Street on Easter Sunday, is because Arlene Foster isn't just the head of the DUP, she's head of state in Northern Ireland, and she represents Catholics and Protestants. And for the Catholic or nationalist people of Northern Ireland, 1916 mattered and matters today.
But she made it absolutely clear she was
of course
never
she did.
Going to accept any
invitation. Of course she
did,
but all I'm saying is that that is a failure of vision, and that I really think that we have to work harder in this state to build bridges and, you know, lay foundations
I think you can separate the two. If you look at the success of the Queen's visit in 2011, for example, which was generally regarded as the icing on the peace process cake, and, you know, there were people who had problems with it, but by and large it was seen as a very successful initiative, the ultimate in bridge building. And yet, that does not mean that commemorating the War of Independence period, 1916 on, has to be part of the same thing. That there are times when you say, right, well, this is what is important to us, to this state, to, you know, what we hold dear, and we are going to do this in a particular way. We don't need endorsement, or we don't need to have some kind of...
I don't see it as endorsement. Well, I just see it as a missed opportunity. I
mean, maybe what Martina, though, is saying is something else, because what you're talking about is we, and we is the Irish state. The way you're talking.
Well, I'm actually
talking
about the people. I don't believe
but the point
that the success of 2016 is about state ownership.
Martina is making is that Northern nationalists, many of them feel themselves to be a part of the Irish nation, and they feel that the Irish state is saying to them, go away.
We will have to look forward to the War of Independence, Civil War, but I just want to address one more fact that, Ronan, perhaps you began to allude to, so I'll put it to you first. I asked my friends when I was coming to this, I said, you know, what do you think about all this whole 1916? And one friend, Mark, said, it's time we faced up as a nation to the fact that this bunch of Gaelic-speaking, God-bothering, proto-fascist, partitionist, putschists left us with a priest-ridden conservative statelet which we still haven't unravelled 100 years later. Now, obviously, plenty of people would disagree with that and say there was a silent counter-revolution, and that's where the property classes came in and left us with the priesthood running the country. But do you think that is a legacy of 1916?
Well, I think Ireland, when you look at Irish history, we've made a complete aim to this country until you realise, when you look at other countries' history, like, for instance, I mean, I know my colleague Stephen Collins never stops in it, but it is true. We are the longest continuing democracy in Europe, or one of them at least. That's a legacy, obviously, the fact that Germans never bothered invading us in the Second World War, but it's true. I mean, we never produced, to our credit, we never produced, for instance, a dictatorship. We never produced, obviously, a Hitler or a Mussolini
so
or Stalin.
So why not?
My theory about this is because
I don't say that with any sense of regret, by the way.
No,
it's only
no.
curiosity.
I think I'll tell you why. I think the reasons why, because fundamentally our because democracy was very well entrenched in Ireland by to the Westminster system, going back to people express themselves to democracy, and we were in many ways. We were fortunate in our revolutionaries, you know, in some ways, because we never produced, as I said, a Stalin-like figure. I mean, you think about next year. How
were we fortunate they were executed?
Well, I mean, I'm not. I hold no torch for the likes of the people who ran the state for the first 50 years. But the fact is, they were Democrats, right? We could have had an awful lot worse. We could have had a Stalin-type figure. I mean, how, for instance, next year are the Russians going to commemorate the centenary of the Russian Revolution? I mean, look at the state they've created. We've created, by and large, in the round, a good state. We're a democratic state. This state works, I think.
Well, Dermot Farter, take us forward then, the War of Independence. Now, you see, Easter 1916, it was 1 week, you know, we could relatively fence it off, you know, but now you're getting into territory that's spread out, you know, all over the country, you know, skirmishes that people can't even agree about the facts, just even starting with Salahead Bay, and then Michael Collins, you know, leading a campaign which was, you know, pretty vicious, and assassinations. How are we going to manage that then?
By doing the same things that we did this year and multiplying them. And it goes back to the idea of complicating the narrative, not accepting that there is one version of the War of Independence or Civil War, acknowledging, as Sean Lamass did in a very interesting interview, because he very rarely spoke about the Civil War. Sean Lamass's brother was savagely killed at the very end of the Civil War in the Dublin Mountains, Knoll. And Sean was asked about it in the 1960s when he was on his last lap of power by an Irish press journalist, Michael McInerney. And he says, both sides were done, or terrible things were done by both sides. I prefer not to talk about it. And he teared up. And that was it. And that was typical of that generation who found the Civil War and some parts of the War of Independence very difficult to talk about it. Because it was true. There were terrible things done by both sides, by British and Irish sides, and between the Irish themselves. So the way to commemorate that is to do it honestly. And if you go back to this question of source material, democratizing the sources so that people have a sense of ownership of the stories, you're saying they're not going to agree on various skirmishes and so on. Well, why would they? Because there is never going to be one version of those local battles or the national picture. So we have to be very conscious of that. One of the legacies of 1916, which is €22 million that was spent on capital projects for the archival material to be released, the military service pension files that have been released, the personal testimony from the era, that again kids would engage with what went on in their families, in their local areas, the recovery of stories that were hidden and suppressed for so long insofar as that is possible. It's not going to be easy. Michael D. Higgins, the president, has addressed this already in a number of different ways by talking about, you know, not allowing a tragic past to colonize the future. But, you know, what's involved in that is a need to confront very, very difficult, not just political, military history and violence and death and suffering, but also social history, class history. There were some people who did very well out of this period of upheaval. There were others who suffered enormously in all sorts of ways.
And
so all of those social themes have to be confronted as well.
And Patsy McGarry, Protestants suffered.
Absolutely.
And you see, now we're getting into really tricky territory.
They were victimising.
Something like Dunmanway, the massacre there after the War of Independence had actually ended.
But I have to come back to what Jim has just said there. I think the President gave an absolutely extraordinary speech at Belle Blanc at the end of August this year, the Michael Collins commemoration, and when he addressed all of this. And I mean, coming from his own background, it's a very personal thing for him, because his father was on one side in the Civil War and his uncle was on the other. And the father was left destitute and died a very poor man and couldn't rear his own kids. So Michael D and his sister ended up being reared by the man, the brother who'd been in the Free State Army,
yeah.
John. So it's a very personal thing for him. And he talked about social history. It's actually well worth reading. And you can read the speech on president.ie. I just had another look at it there again tonight. But this is where I have a different tack, if you like. where I believe democracy begins to reassert itself in the election of 1918, when the vast majority of Irish people, it was put before them, separatism was the idea, and the great majority voted for a separate parliament in Dublin. Sinn Féin got 73 seats, I think it was, or thereabouts. 25 are uncontested. The Unionists got, I think it was about 25, I can't remember the exact details, but it was clear the Irish people expressed themselves politically. Indeed, as it could be said, they had done, in 1910 was the last election for the war, when they gave such a big majority to 74 again, I think it was, to the Home Rule Party. So democracy reasserts itself. Sinn Féin now has legitimacy to set up its own parliament in Dublin. On the same day Sulahad Beg happened, to me that was just blatant murder. It had no legitimacy and no authorization from anybody. They picked off two Catholic RIC men, one a widower with four kids, another a young man from Cork, who was just got engaged. Subsequent military action, I do believe, had legitimacy because they were defending the decision of the Irish people. But that particular act did not.
Right, but Margaret O'Callaghan, excuse me. You see, with 1916 and with the War of Independence...
Could I just continue on something Patsy was saying there? What I get worried about in this whole period is, you know, democratisation in Ireland is kind of from the 1880s to the 1920s. It's a 50-year period. Everything that happens in Ireland does not happen in a vacuum. It happens in relation to the location of power, and the location of power in Ireland is in London. Activities like Sulahad Beg, what happened in 1919, all have to be considered in relation to decisions made in London after the release of internees, decisions about whether or not to implement partial home rule settlements, Walter Long, the cabinet subcommittees on Ireland. Things don't happen in Ireland in a vacuum. They happen in response to political decisions, military interventions, imprisonments, denial of recognition to the First Dáil. So you just can't talk about Ireland like it's a place sealed off. Power in Ireland rests in London. Anglo-Irish relations are at the centre of understanding this period. To view the place as autonomous is just mad.
Just to finish that,
yes, Dermot.
Michael Hopkinson, a historian who died a couple of weeks ago, important books on the Civil War, Green Against Green, and the War of Independence. And the very point that he was making and why his book on the War of Independence was such a new departure was precisely because he was excavating the British side of the story. Mm-hmm. What was the British official thinking on Ireland? Politically, militarily, socially, religiously, everything. And if you can, try and find a way to document the British thinking, the attitudes that existed at that time. Why did this war evolve the way it did? And as Margaret says, it's not just an Irish story.
Because it was repellent and repugnant to the British cabinet to lose Ireland. Yeah. It was an atrocious loss for them. In imperial terms, it was highly significant. Retaining any part of the island, i.e. Northern Ireland, mitigated the pain of that loss. Yeah. And every obstacle was put in the way of a Democrat. Okay, past a certain point, I think by 21, there's a decision, give them some kind of a deal. But, I mean, you just cannot understand the period without understanding British high politics.
Yeah. Okay, but how do you deal, though, with something like Ballyseedy? It's just one of those...
I don't have to deal with Ballyseedy. Okay. I'm a historian. I don't write about Ballyseedy. all societies, most Western democracies are born in conflict or war. Ceremony and pomp are the clothing that states put upon their bloody origins to conceal them. That's very difficult to do in a society where you have a conflict that is ongoing, as we have had on this island from the 60s onwards. Therefore, this whole thing that the Irish are somehow peculiarly addicted to violence is nonsense. It's not about violence, it's about the desire to pursue particular kinds of political ends in a divided society where you have another population, as you do in the north, who think differently. In my own opinion, the Irish situation is a quasi-colonial residue of four or five centuries of British rule. But that is my view.
And you're talking about what to do with Ballyseedy. You get every bit of information that you possibly can
I don't think we need every bit of information on every minor killing on every back road in the whole of Ireland. I think it would be a disaster.
Ronan, I want to quote you Martin Manser. And he was delivering an oration at Kilcrumper Cemetery in Fermoy, which is where General Liam Lynch is buried.
Yes.
And he echoed President Michael D. Higgins' comments at Bernard Law, and he said, inevitably, as we approach the centenary of the treaty split in the Civil War, the rights and wrongs on all sides will continue to be explored and debated. But as the President has emphasised, it should not be done in an overly partisan manner or in a spirit of bitterness or recrimination. And this is the interesting bit. No side had the monopoly of right in their actions. And it must never be forgotten, and this is echoing what Margaret was saying, that there was a third party, mm-hmm. the departing British power. However, as Patsy was saying, democracy has asserted itself at this point. There was a democratically elected Dáil. There was a democratically elected vote, and one side ignored that vote and took matters into their own hands.
I think that goes to the heart of the debate on the Civil War. I mean, if we are going to have a debate, the question is this, right? You have the treaty that is passed by a slim majority in the Dáil in early 22.
Seven votes.
Yeah, and then you have, but then you have the election of May or June 22, in which I think between, about 60 to 70% of the parties in it are pro the treaty, right? Now, the question is, right, about the, there was terrible atrocities carried out in the Civil War, and in fact, you know, for every atrocity you find on one side, you'll find almost like an equivalent of. But the question is, the Free State acted in a really violent manner towards the anti-treaty forces. 77, 81, I think, is the executions. The Ballyseedy ambush, right? If any, some of you will know about it. They the Free State Army tied 8 treaty rebels to a landmine and blew them up. One of them survived. That's how we know about it, right? That's what ISIS did. ISIS was doing that a couple of years back. And the question is, right, and this is not a rhetorical question, so I'm not sure I know the answer to this, but it will be central to our discussions on the Civil War. Was the violence of the Free State justified? In the sense that you had an anti-democratic side that refused to accept the will of the people, that was murdering TDs, as in Sean Hills, that was murdering Gardaí or RIC officers, as of then, were murdering Free State or killing Free State soldiers. I think that the Civil War, when we come to debate it, I think that's the central question.
So, Martina Devlin, I mean, my concern would be, you know, you can be as inclusive as you want, but at some point, being that inclusive means you're just ignoring the facts. And the facts were democracy was usurped in the Civil War. How are you going to commemorate that?
Well,
that's not a fact.
That's a Fine Gael point.
That is not a fact.
There are no
this is the high moral ground Fine Gael point of view.
I let Martina.
The old shirt coming out instead.
I let Martina answer my highly inflammatory question, and then Dermot can correct the record.
For me, I struggle really. I find it very, it's very nuanced, and I find it difficult to judge. Nor is it my place to judge. Of course, it's not. But what I would say is that I find that decision to ratify the treaty highly questionable, because the Dáil, members of the Dáil, had taken an oath to uphold the Republic, and then they decommissioned the Republic and made it a free state. So, you know, you could question how legitimate that was. Well, yes, but even before we get to abandoning the North, you know, the Catholic minority in the North, even before that, you could question whether they had the right, they had the power, but did they have the right to unmake the Republic, which is effectively what they did with the Anglo-Irish Treaty. And then, of course, you know, the Civil War, I mean, you know, horrible, horrible. It, you know, descended into the most awful cycle of reprisals, as we've heard. But that delayed dealing with the boundary. So, that, you know, Northern Ireland had been set up in 1920. And the thing that amazes me is people forget that the border was provisional. It was a temporary border which had to be agreed. And it was to be agreed, and this is the wording of Article 12 of the treaty, in accordance with the wishes of the people. In accordance with the wishes of the people.
Yeah, but also and economic and, yes, and geographic yes, considerations.
Yes,
and
you're right. It was in accordance with
that.
The wishes of yeah. the people, taking into account economic and geographic yeah. conditions. But nevertheless, in accordance with the wishes of the people was a really prime part of it. And that element was overlooked totally. So, you know, when I hear the word democracy bandied around here, there was a complete absence of democracy in agreeing.
The worst thing you could do with, you know, assessing the Civil War is to break it down to democracy versus dictatorship.
Yeah, but we're hearing
because,
democracy.
You know, exactly.
Used.
And you're talking about nuance. Of course, the Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed under threat of war. The June 1922 general election was, you know, held in a particular atmosphere that was very, very difficult, and the consequences for making particular choices, particular political choices, were being talked about in a very ominous and threatening way by people like Winston Churchill, Secretary of State for the Colonies at the time. And then you have how Republicans viewed what they regarded as the betrayal. Mary McSweeney, for example, who was writing to De Valera during the Civil War, and she said, "You don't understand, we hold the Republic as a living faith, as a spiritual entity. There's no point in us being cynical about that perspective now." That was what they felt, and I know Margaret loves high politics and there's no interest in the peasants in Kerry. But, you know, if you talk about feeling and the depth of feeling at the level of the volunteer, that's what you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And it's not irrational. And
our
it's
brother
not
died in hunger strike. The activity of De Valera, particularly in rejecting or ignoring that decision of the Dáil, was consistent with his stance in 1916 and with the stance of Pearson Company in 1916. When he wanted to know what was good for the Irish people, he looked into his own heart rather than consulting them. But to come back to the issue of the violence and the disproportionate violence in 1916, the state, the Free State in particular, did employ hugely disproportionate violence, not least when they attacked the forecourts, for instance.
And do you think, was it justified?
No, I don't think, they were certainly, they were right to try and get the rebels out, but not in blowing up the building and away many hundreds of years of Irish history.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, round of applause for your panel, please. They worked hard tonight. Thanks to the Dublin Festival of History for bringing us all here tonight. I have enjoyed the discussion and I really hope you have too. Good night.
Thank you for listening to this Dublin Festival of History podcast, brought to you by Dublin City Council. To hear more, please subscribe on iTunes or SoundCloud. You can also follow us on Twitter or visit our website, dublinfestivalofhistory.ie, where you can sign up for our newsletter.